modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week, we examine the blues.
When we talk about the contributions that poor women, poor black women made, we're not supposed to acknowledge them as having been agents of history.
Today we present Professor Angela Davis speaking on blues legacies and black feminism, and we have a special rare program of 1920s blues legend Alberta Hunter, recorded in 1978 at Pacifica Radio.
By and by, when that morning comes.
The blues are commonly thought of as one of the most important and influential popular music styles originating right here in the United States. As the Black Power movement was taking shape in 1963, poet Leroy Jones, now known as Amiri Baraka, wrote a book called Blues People, Negro Music in White America. The book examined this art form as a continuum, accounting for the blues' ability to evolve from the Negro spirituals to each subsequent incarnation of classic blues, boogie-woogie, swing, bebop, cool jazz, and any future music intimately tied to the Black experience. And then in 1998, Angela Davis focused on a very specific aspect of the blues in her book, Blues Legacies and Black Feminism, Gertrude Ma Rainey, Bessie Smith, and Billie Holiday. Professor Davis uses the music of original blues women from the 1920s, and later Billie Holiday, to illustrate the struggle, heartbreak, and victories of women throughout the 20th century. Here is Professor Angela Davis from her 1998 book signing tour of Blues Legacies and Black Feminism.
I guess what I'll try to do is situate the work I did on this book, Blues Legacies and Black Feminism, within a context of women's history, within a context of trying to uncover women's history from marginalized communities, from hidden sources. Because as we think about our relationship to history and as we continually construct our history, there are certain aspects of that history that are never supposed to be discovered, that are supposed to remain hidden. When we talk about the contributions that poor women, poor black women made, we're not supposed to acknowledge them as having been agents of history, and certainly not of having played a role in shaping what we might call feminist historical traditions. And in a sense, to talk about women like Gertrude Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith, and Billie Holiday in the same breath as one uses the word feminist, disturbs people. It disturbs people who have a certain notion of what it means to be feminist on the one side, and it disturbs people who are totally opposed to feminism on the other side. And I think that's what I wanted to do. You know, although I never imagined myself to be a person who would sort of trouble people and shake people up, it seems that that's been my destiny. It was sort of offered to me. And so in another way, I've tried to do that with this book. I've tried to explore our relationship to history in different ways from the ones to which we are accustomed. I tried to talk about or think about, you know, questions of sexuality, for example, within the kind of political context that we've, you know, learned how to establish today, and to use that to raise questions about the history that we often don't acknowledge, the history of the blues. I know that some people who are musicologists and music historians might be upset about a book like this because it doesn't exactly conform to the standards that have been set by the musicologists and the blues historians. And I actually tried to approach the music not as a musicologist, not as an expert, but as a listener, as someone who believes that music shapes our lives in fundamental ways, often ways that we do not acknowledge. Music helps to create the climate in which we live. It helps to shape our views about the world. And so it occurred to me that if I were going to seriously try to look at history from the vantage point of poor women, from the vantage point of working class women, I would have to find some texts that are different from the written texts that we normally use when we do this kind of research. Because the women I was concerned about didn't have access to the institutions that produced those literary texts, perhaps didn't have the skills required to produce them in the way that we are accustomed to receiving them. But of course, during the 1920s, black women recorded hundreds and hundreds of blues songs. The 1920s was considered the era of the classic blues. It was the era during which women recorded songs about virtually anything you can imagine. And in 1920, a woman by the name of Mamie Smith accidentally recorded a song, accidentally, because when the white woman who was supposed to be in the recording studio that day got sick, you know, she was invited to take her place. And this song sold. This record sold. And so the company was convinced to allow her to record a blues song, which she did, Crazy Blues. This blues song sold 75,000 copies. This record sold 75,000 copies within 1 month. And it was black people who bought the record for a dollar a piece, which was a lot of money in those days. You know, more like what, $25, $30? About the price of this book. Probably. Which is like really expensive. But the point is, the record companies realized that they had this market, this untapped market, this unacknowledged market in black communities. And therefore, they began to court all kinds of black women blues singers to record the blues. So as a result of this sort of capitalist strategy that led to race records in virtually every existing recording company at that time, as a result of that, we have this marvelous collection of oral texts, we might say, that give us an idea of how poor people, poor women, poor black women were thinking about a whole range of subjects. And one of those subjects is sexuality. And I mention sexuality because it's always been such a taboo subject. It still is. And even as women like Ida Wells and Anna Julia Cooper and Mary Church Terrell and all of the women who were involved in the emergence of the Black Women's Club movement attempted to establish relationships with poor women that were based on the notion of lifting as we climb. There was not the ability to acknowledge the importance of the way poor women talked about sexuality. I mean, there was a politics of sexuality there that perhaps we can only recognize from the vantage point of the 90s, looking back at the 1920s. And it occurred to me in listening to these blues songs that there was a reason why so many of these songs have as their core theme love or sex or sexuality. There's some sexual theme that is the core theme of virtually every song. And it occurred to me that for a people who had been held in slavery and who for so long had been denied the right to make choices about the kinds of relationships they would enter into, about, you know, who they would share their lives with, about whom they would share their lives with, that the abolition of slavery meant that they could make autonomous, independent decisions about matters of love or matters of sex, about who to enter into a sexual relationship with, whether it be a couple of days or, you know, a couple of weeks or a couple of years or for a lifetime. And this was quite radical, particularly since during slavery, in many instances, Black people were literally mated with each other. That sexual desire was supposed to be subordinated to the economic goal of reproducing the slave population. And so in the aftermath of slavery, it must have been revolutionary to be able to think about making decisions about sexual partnerships that had never been possible before. I mean, do you understand what I'm saying? I just want to make sure you're with me. You know, because oftentimes when you talk about sex or sexuality, people sort of become very close-minded. And I think this is so important because if you consider that in recent times, in contemporary times, women on welfare, Black, Latina, poor women on welfare, single women have been demonized as these sexually promiscuous women who are only interested in having sex and having babies. And oftentimes people who may otherwise consider themselves allies in the struggle against racism, or who might consider themselves agents of the struggle against racism, when they hear somebody represented as sexually promiscuous, they think, oh, you know, this is somebody we can dismiss. You know, we don't have to, you know, think about her. Or they hear about someone represented as a criminal, someone who goes to prison. We can forget about her or him. And in the process, of course, you know, what happened was the whole system of AFDC was dismantled with poor women being represented as the enemies of this society, as the reason why there are such vast economic problems, problems with the budget. Welfare was 1% of the budget, right? So they talk about welfare women as opposed to talking about the Pentagon. If you're talking, you know, if you want to talk about budget problems, so. So, you know, so getting back to the blues, it seems to me that these themes of sex and sexuality that have turned so many people off, that have made people view this music as raunchy, as raw. I think that those look like students who feel that perhaps they shouldn't be involved in this conversation. But as I said, returning to the blues, it seems to me that these themes of sexuality point to possibilities of liberation, of emancipation. Since sexuality was one realm in which Black people could tangibly, palpably experience emancipation, feel what it felt like to be free, then these themes of sexuality hold promises of economic freedom, of political freedom, of other forms of emancipation. And this is why I argue those themes of sexuality are so central to the blues, and why the blues as a genre can address sexuality in such an open fashion that, you know, Ma Rainey on the one hand can talk about, can sing about her sexual desire or women's sexual desire, and can sing about needing a man. And, you know, she can sing, you know, she wants a man, she doesn't care what kind of man, any old man. You know, he can be a Zulu, a Voodoo, or any old man. But then on the other hand, she'll sing a song saying, that says, trust no man, as an advice song to women not to subordinate themselves in the way the dominant culture assumed women were supposed to do. And then she can also sing a song that's called Prove It On Me Blues, which goes, went out last night with a bunch of my friends. They must have been women, because I don't like no men. You know? So, and then she can also sing a song that's called Sissy Blues, in which she describes how she feels when she discovers that her partner, her male partner, has gotten involved with another man. And those lyrics are a little risque. If you want to check them out, you can look at the book. But the point that I'm making is that this very openness, this disrespect for the prevailing taboos around questions of sexuality, pointed to freedom in this indivisible way, freedom. With respect to gender as well as race, freedom with respect to sexuality as well as to gender. So I think that there is a great deal to be excavated in this music, lessons that we can learn today. I only focused on three women. I focused on Gertrude Ma Rainey because she's considered the mother of the blues, Bessie Smith because she received the title Empress of the Blues, and in a sense, Ma Rainey is very close to the, you know, sort of rural country folk traditions. Bessie Smith sings in a much more sophisticated way and creates these marvelous images of love and sexual relationships. And then there's Billie Holiday, who is not a blues singer, right? As a matter of fact, we tend to put the blues singers, we tend to compartmentalize them in a past history. And so, you know, we may know about Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith and Ida Cox and Victoria Spivey and Rosa Henderson and Ethel Waters and Alberta Hunter and all of the other women who sang the blues in the 1920s, but we don't necessarily listen to them. But we listen to Billie Holiday, right? Am I right? Or am I wrong? I don't know. Do you listen to Billie Holiday? I mean, there is something so powerful about her music that it has been able to travel across time from generation to generation. And each generation can figure out a relationship to this music and can find pleasure in it. And this is what really fascinated me about Billie Holiday. And then, of course, the fact that she sang Strange Fruit. And it seemed to me that anyone who could sing a song like Strange Fruit had to be really deep, right? And that there had to be a lot more to discover about her than we normally learn about her. Billie Holiday is largely represented as a woman who was a drug addict, right? I mean, we know more about her drug habit than we know about her brilliance as an artist, am I right? And we know more about all of the troubles she had with men than we know about the way in which she was able to transcend or recast those troubles and the music that she sang, thus appealing to women today who consider themselves feminists and who would never use the kinds of words that were used in the popular music of Billie Holiday's time to describe relationships between men and women. Nonetheless, many of these women love Billie Holiday. So I figured that there had to be some way to explain that. You know, this woman who decided to sing a song called Strange Fruit about lynching that revolutionized popular music. I mean, nobody had ever sung a song like that before and expected to be taken seriously and not run out of town. You know, particularly when you're talking about singing to people who saw popular music or jazz music as an escape, as a way to elude the problems that they normally dealt with during the course of the day. And I mean, if you can imagine her singing this song in a dark nightclub, you know, where people are smoking and drinking and laying back and sort of chilling. And then suddenly she creates this portrait of a lynching, of the worst form of racist violence. And again, you know, Billie Holiday troubled people. We're talking about troubling and disturbing people. I mean, that is what she did with that song, and she had to know that that is what she was doing. So it seemed to me that it made sense to look at the love songs that she sang, the sort of Tin Pan Alley tunes that she took and recast and asked questions about the ways in which she may have transformed the meaning of those songs by the way that she offered them to us. And so as I conclude, I want to again point out that there is a relationship that we often don't acknowledge between art and politics, between music and consciousness. Probably young people today are most informed in terms of their view of the world, in terms of their social awareness, that they are more informed by music than anything else. And something else has struck me about the younger generation, because you see, when we're older, when we are younger ourselves, we always promise that we will not behave towards those who are younger than us later on the way the elder generation treated us. Am I right? I mean, we always make that promise. And then when we get older, we forget. We forget that we are now older, right? We assume that we are, you know, always those young. I mean, most of us think of ourselves as the way we were when we were young, right? And so therefore, we think we have the legitimacy to treat young people today as if they knew nothing at all, right? Why aren't you out there marching the way we were when we were your age, you know? What are you listening to that music for, right? I mean, these are the kinds of, these are the things that were said to us. And so I really think that we need to be sensitive to the way in which each generation tries to find its own path. And the music that they listen to often helps them find that path. And I think that, you know, rather than spending all of the time that people of my generation sometimes spend, you know, criticizing hip-hop and rap, we ought to look at some of the really exciting developments that are occurring, you know, within hip-hop, within the whole popular music realm. And it occurs to me that today young people are often attracted to popular culture, whether it's music or filmmaking or spoken word, in the same ways that we were once attracted to political organizing, because we thought we could help to change the world. And I think that young people see popular culture as a way of participating in the effort to transform people's consciousness in a progressive way. And I think we need to applaud that. Which isn't to say that we also shouldn't be out there marching and doing all the other things that have worked. And, you know, right now I'm involved in an effort to launch a national campaign to dismantle, to begin to dismantle the prison industrial complex. You know, when I first became an activist in the realm of prison issues, political prisoners, prisoners' rights, it was right here in Southern California, in LA. And I can remember thinking that there were a lot of people in prison in this country. What, 150,000 or something like that? 200, I can't remember exactly, but I can remember thinking that there were an enormous amount of people in prison. And then, you know, there were like 500,000 people in prison, 500,000 people. And then we heard that there were 1 million people in prison. And then it was 1.5 million. And then it was 1.6, 1.7, 1.8. And the latest figures I've heard indicate that there are 1.9 million people in the prisons and jails of this country. And most of us don't even think about it. Most of us do what we do every day, totally ignoring the fact that ever-increasing numbers of our community are being hidden away, treated as expendable, destroyed in these institutions that used to at least be represented as places of rehabilitation, but now they're not even being, I mean, there isn't even the pretense of rehabilitation. It's about punishment, only about punishment, and punishment that is more and more and more repressive. And there are more women behind bars. You know, most of us who got involved in this movement learned how to talk about men in prison. But we didn't learn how to talk about women. And of course, historically, the numbers of women have been relatively small. But historically, women have been punished within the private sphere. Right? You know someone in prison. Or if you don't know someone, if you don't have a relative, a lot of us have relatives, am I right? And we don't even admit it. We don't even talk about it. We're ashamed. You know, it's as if as soon as someone is sent to prison, that in itself becomes a way of affirming the criminality of that person when you know that that person is just as humane as anyone else. You know that that person may only be in there because she or he made a mistake, got caught at something that other people do and don't get caught at, right? Because some communities, black communities, Chicano communities, Latino communities are watched. They are under surveillance. They are under surveillance. So that when someone does, say, steal something out of a store, then that person is going to go to prison. And if it's the third time, that person may go to prison for life. You know, a white person may go in and have a ball, but nobody's watching the white person because it's the people of color who have already been criminalized before ever even thinking about committing a criminal act. And besides, there are all of these other forms of crime, right, that never get talked about. There's corporate crime. There's crime against the environment. You know, there's crime that happens in the home. So let's wake up. You know, let's wake up. One of the reasons I was so interested in doing this research on women in the blues is because I thought that their music was, in many ways, so... it was so honest and so stark in a lot of ways that it forces you to think critically. It forces you to take things seriously, you know, even when they're presented with humor. And what can we do today to get people to take the prison industrial complex seriously? You know, what can we do? I want you to think about that and let me know when I begin the book signing phase of the program. Thank you very much.
That was Professor Angela Davis from her book signing tour of her 1998 release, Blues Legacies and Black Feminism, Gertrude Ma Rainey, Bessie Smith, and Billie Holiday, recorded in 1998 here in Los Angeles. You're listening to From the Vault. For a copy of this program or to browse other programs in the series, go to fromthevaultradio.org. That's fromthevaultradio.org. Or call the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230.
I ain't never known. Julia Papa. Got to come on the Marshall Band.
Next, we hear a special live performance from blues legend Alberta Hunter, recorded in 1978. Born in 1895, Ms. Hunter began her career in the early 1920s. A contemporary of Ma Rainey and Bessie Smith, Ms. Hunter became hugely successful with a string of hits like Downhearted Blues and My Man is Such a Handyman. In 1928, she played Queenie opposite Paul Robeson in the first London production of Showboat. By the 1950s, she had retired from show business and had begun her career in nursing. When the hospital forced her to retire in 1977, she began to perform again. Pacifica was there in 1978 to record this Alberta set. Thanks to a grant from the Grammy Foundation and from listener sponsors of Pacifica, we were able to remaster this rare 1978 recording with Alberta Hunter. And now we present her performance, perhaps for the first time since its original broadcast.
By and by, when that morning comes, all the saints are gone together in home. We're gonna tell that story, how we overcome. Of course, we'll understand it better by and by. I say now, by and by, when that morning comes, all the saints are gathering home. We're gonna tell that story, how we overcome. Cause we'll understand it better by and by. I say, by and by,
record producer Chris Albertson reflects on his 17-year association with Alberta Hunter.
When I first met Alberta, I talked to her on the phone and I met her in the studio. And I was amazed that she was still around. This is 1961, you know, 17 years ago. And I was even more amazed that she could sing. Then I saw her over the years, and Alberta was always walking around with her shopping bags and with her work clothes, and she loves to go to Macy's, and she loves to go to Bloomingdale's, and she goes to all these stores, and she takes the bus, and she wanders around. She comes by my apartment. She calls me up and says, I'm coming by. And she comes by straight from Macy's meat department and brings me pork chops and oxtails and things, and I can't stop her, you see. And she's sort of taken a motherly attitude, you know, and it's wonderful. You know, I told my mother about it. My mother lives in Seattle. My mother feels a lot better because Alberta is taking care of me. But she always calls up, you know, do you have enough food in the house, you know? And then she runs around. I mean, this is when she was working as a nurse, where she worked a full day, you know, and often longer hours than most people, standing on her feet. And yet when she was off, and she worked the night shift, she spent the day running around and buying the food that she sent down south and buying food for me and so forth, always with an ice pick in one of her shopping bags, always shopping bags. The ice pick was for protection in case something ever should happen, and thank God nothing ever has. So that was one side of her, and then to see her walking through Macy's or on the street, you would never dream that this was a woman who'd ever been in show business. No, know, much less that it was someone who still had it. She never talked about the old days, oh, the good old days and the great old days. She never lived in the past. I always liked that about Alberta. She loved young people, and she loves New York. And I remember one time walking down 34th Street, and this police car came by with the sirens, you know, and it was enough to annoy anyone, blasting right past you. And Alberta turned to me and said, oh, isn't it wonderful? It's just so New York, you know. There's only one New York. And she loved it. So she's always had that very youthful spirit, see. Then when it comes down to business, you know, I go over to her house in Roosevelt Island, and she brings out these contracts, and she asks me to fill them out, but she tells me how to fill them out. She just wants me to do the actual writing sometimes, easier. But she tells me how to, I don't know how to fill those forms out, but she, those copyright forms, she knows exactly what has to be put down there, where it has to be mailed, and so forth. Takes care of all that business. And not only is she singing, but she's composing songs still. She did a song, My Two-Fisted Double-Jointed Rough and Ready Man, and she sings about love, and she sings about everything. And she knows what she's singing about, you know, and she's not doing a nostalgia trip, you see. I mean, she could get up there and talk about how she wrote this song for Bessie Smith and all, and get into all that and what she did in the 30s and at the Dorchester Hotel in London. She doesn't. You know, she mentioned the Bessie Smith song, it's only because I told her to. You know, at first she wasn't going to say anything. I said, well, say something, because most people, at least in the beginning, will not know who you are, you know, and not know, people don't know unless they read about it, you know. This woman has so many accomplishments. When Alberta went into nursing, she simply lied about her age, you know, and she was in a very good position to do that, because she didn't act like a 62-year-old. And how many 62-year-olds will go into a whole new profession? You know, but that's Alberta, you see. She'll do that. And then when that was over and she couldn't do any more, she simply went back to her old profession instead of retiring. And Alberta is well enough situated financially that she didn't have to work. She could just rest on her laurels and lead a quiet life, you know. But the quiet life is not for Alberta. She needs that excitement. And she loves every minute of it. She loves the photographers flashing. She loves the young people who come there with big eyes and surround her like she was some relic, you know, and they do. But she loves every minute of it. And she keeps saying to me, Chris, I don't know why people like me so much. What is it? I said, well, it's because you're very lovable. You're just great. She said, I don't understand it, but I love every minute of it.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Somebody loves you.
Somebody loves you.
I don't know that. But I'll sing a song. I'll sing a song that Bessie Smith used to sing. Nobody knows you when you're down and out. Oh, I love you. I love you. Oh, thank you. You don't know what that applause is doing for me. You don't know. I can't express in words. Thank you. Thank you. Once I lived the life of a millionaire, spending my money and I didn't care, taking my friends out to have a good time, buying bootleg liquor, champagne and wine. But as soon as I begin to drop real low, I didn't have a friend and no place to go. But if I ever get my hands on a dollar again, I'm gonna squeeze it and squeeze it until that eagle grins. 'Cause nobody knows you when you're down and out. Oh, the truth. In your pocket, not one penny. so-called friends. You haven't any, but as soon as you get on your feet, many friends you chance to meet. Ah, but it's strange to say, without a doubt, nobody knows you when you are down and out. They don't know you when you are down and out. I say now, nobody knows you when you're down and out. Oh, you know, in your pocket, not one penny. And friends, you haven't any. But if I ever get a chance to meet my friends again, I've learned my lesson, and I know just when. Oh, if I get my hands on a dollar again, I'm gonna squeeze it. I'm gonna hold it. 'Cause nobody knows you. Nobody wants you. No, nobody knows you when you're down and out.
You know, I told you I got up at 7 o'clock this morning. Now, I worked last night. I had three tough shows. And they were tough because those audiences at that cookery, they are so marvelous. Now, Charlie Bourgeois, you know, the fellow that supervises the jazz festivals. Yes. He said to me, why don't you go back and show me? I saw him looking at me. I said to myself, what is this man looking at me so far? And he said, why don't you go back and show business? And I said, I'm no baby. He said, neither's Mabel Mercer. But so many people there, I guess, had been talking to him about me. Mary McParland and the different ones had been telling him about me, you know, and Bobby and Jimmy Daniels. And that's what caused him to say, why don't you talk to Bonnie Josephson? So I said, now, to show you I wasn't interested, I said, if Bonnie Josephson wants me, let him talk to me. So Bonnie Josephson called me the next morning. He said, come down and talk to me. And I had always wanted to work at the Cafe Society when he had Cafe Society uptown and downtown. This is the same man that has a cookery now, you know. Well, I had always wanted to work at Cafe Society, and when he said Bonnie Josephson, I said to him, I said, well, I am going down there and talk to him. So I went down, and after talking with him just a few minutes, I was convinced that this is the man that I want to work for. The minute he opens his mouth, you can see he's the personification of honesty. You know, we don't need contracts to work for Bonnie Josephson. We don't use contracts with him. And I went down and talked with him, and I said, well, this is where I'm going to work. So he said, well, you open here October the 10th. Now, out of the clear blue sky, he didn't know what was going to come out of my mouth, and neither did I, because I hadn't sung. And I'm truthful with you when I tell you I hadn't sung, you know. So when I opened down there, and I don't know, when it came out, I was kind of surprised myself, you know. And he was seemed to be so pleased. And I'm extremely happy. I feel that I've tried to do my best. Everything that I have started at, I have tried to do the best at that particular thing. When I was in show business before, I did my best. When I went into nursing, I certainly tried to do my best. And now that I'm back in it again, I'm going to give everything that I have to offer that's in my power, that the strength that God has given me to give, I'm going to try to give to them and to be loyal to people that have been loyal to me and to people that have supported me and helped me. I hope the wheel of fortune will always turn in their favor. Thank you.
is the truth, ladies and gentlemen. Thank God it's never happened to me, but it's happened to many a one. And when you get your hands on a penny, if you have 25 cents, try to save 10 cents of it anywhere. Because when you have money, you can talk big. But if you don't have any money, it's shame on you. I'm telling you. So, come on up some night, my castle's rocking, signing off. You can blow your wig, cause everything's free, yeah. On the top floor, the third door to the rear, that's where I am residing. Stuff is there and the chicks fairly romp with glee. Don't worry about a thing, cause I'm paying the cops for protection. Yeah. Tell them cats downtown they can let their conscience be. Come on up anytime. Right. And we'll start that joint of jumping. My castle's rocking. Yes, my pad is popping. Oh, my castle's rocking. Run on by and see. Yeah.
Since Alberta Hunter's historic comeback at the Cookery in October 1977, she recorded and wrote the musical score for a new Robert Altman film, Remember My Name. She also recorded an album for John Hammond, due for release around March of 1978. As of now, Alberta Hunter continues to sing at the Cookery. Her engagement there is to run for as long as she wishes. This program was produced by Natasha and Ralph Fryer, created and edited by Natasha Fryer. Alberta Hunter's recordings, courtesy of Chris Albertson. Alberta's performance at the Cookery was recorded by engineer Dave Marks. Final production mixed by Dave Marks. Here is Alberta Hunter's triumphant closing number, her version of Handyman.
We've got to thank you, darling. Thank you, Bernie. Handyman, I'm going to lay it on you this time. Thanks, Odetta. This is that wonderful Odetta, ladies and gentlemen. This is that wonderful Odetta. Thank you. Whoever said a good man was hard to find, positively, absolutely sure was blind. Because I've just found the best man that ever was. And here's just a few of the things that he does. He shakes my ashes. He greases my griddle. He churns my butter. And he strokes my fiddle. My man. A mess. Is such a handy man. Ah, he threads my needle and he creams my wheat. He heats my heater and he chops my meat. My man, he's a mess. He is such a handy man. Oh, what a man. Folks, I don't care if you believe or not. Play it for me. He's a mighty good man to have around. Oh, 'cause when my furnace gets too hot, he's right there to turn my damper down. For everything that man of mine.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Wednesday, March 13th. Here are some headlines. The U.S. House of Representatives today voted 352-65 in favor of a bill that would ban TikTok nationwide if the popular app continues to be controlled by a Chinese parent company. The bill now faces an uncertain future in the Senate. The Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act would force ByteDance, TikTok's China-based parent company, to divest the app within roughly 5 months of going into effect, or be banned from U.S. app stores and web hosting services. ByteDance has denied claims of government influence and stresses it does not share data of U.S. users with the Chinese authorities. And following yesterday's primaries, President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump appear set for a rematch in November after both candidates secured enough delegates to win their party's nomination. Both will now have to be formally nominated at their respective parties' conventions this summer to make it official. It will be the first presidential rematch in the United States since 1956. Biden and Trump both won races Tuesday in Georgia, Mississippi, and Washington State, where over 7% of Democratic voters chose uncommitted as part of an ongoing protest over Biden's support for Israel's assault on Gaza. This year, voters have expressed little enthusiasm for a repeat of the bitter 2020 election, with polls showing both Biden and Trump are unpopular. In other news, a group of 8 senators is calling on President Biden to enforce federal law by requiring Israel to stop restricting humanitarian aid access to Gaza or forfeit U.S. military aid. In a letter to Biden released yesterday, Senator Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, and 7 Democrats argued that by continuing to arm Israel, the president was violating the Foreign Assistance Act, which bars military support from going to any nation that restricts the delivery of humanitarian aid. As the letter states, quote, "Federal law is clear, and given the urgency of the crisis in Gaza and the repeated refusal of Prime Minister Netanyahu to address U.S. concerns on this issue, immediate action is necessary to secure a change in policy by his government," close quote. In related news, the head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says more children have been killed in Israel's conflict in Gaza than in 4 years of conflicts worldwide. In a post on X yesterday, Philippe Lazzarini cited United Nations numbers showing that 12,193 children had been killed in conflicts worldwide between 2019 and 2022. He compared that to reports from the Gaza Health Ministry indicating that more than 12,300 children died in the Palestinian territory between last October and the end of February. "This is a war on children," he wrote. Quote, "It is a war on their childhood and their future," close quote. And he called for an immediate ceasefire for the sake of children in Gaza.